Well, which one of you thought up Agent Pendergast? Was that you, Lincoln, or was it Douglas?
Actually, what happened was, back in those days, Doug wrote almost all the first drafts of the chapters based on my outlines, and I revised them and edited them. And he submitted, like, chapter 5 or chapter 6, and it had two exactly stereotypical New York police detectives investigating the case. One was Italian, one was, you know, Irish, but they were functionally the same character. And so I said to him, people aren't going to recognize these two as individuals. You have to change one of them. And Doug, who was always very quick to take offense at any, you know, corrections or improvements I make to his prose, said very sarcastically, "Oh, like what? Make one of them an albino from New Orleans?" And I said, "You know, maybe that's not a bad idea." But the funny thing about Pendergast is that if you ask either Doug or myself, who invented a character, or how did a character, you know, whether it be Corey Swanson or Bill Smithback or Constance Green, where did that character come from? We can tell you. But in the case of Pendergast, it's the one character that seemed to sort of spring fully formed onto the page. And we can't tell you for the life of us, you know, how that happened. And, you know, he's dominated our lives ever since. I mean, you know, he took over the series. He turned a single book into first a book with a sequel, and then it turned into a whole series of books. He's created a mini universe around him of characters, you know, lovers, loved ones, friends, enemies, and another person that you will meet that I can't say anything more about, which completes his family tableau. But we didn't see any of this coming. You know, it's remarkable how he has commandeered our writing career and made it his own, despite his many pretending complaints that he dislikes our reportage of his doings.
It's hard to believe, looking at you in that shirt, that this isn't a man who comes only in black suits, Agent Pendergast, but at least he wears long, elegant coats, right? Is that you, Doug? Are you the person wearing long, elegant coats?
Well, I try, but I don't know. I got my gangster jacket on, though.
You do? But yeah. When we started this 12 books ago, you didn't have that beautiful white hair you've got today. So how come that Pendergast, is it because he thought he'd be interesting as an albino?
Oh, Pendergast has given me gray hairs. You know, he's really...
Okay. Now, if you go to agentpendergast.com, which is another website involved here, here are some questions that I'm going to ask the authors for answers to because I don't know what they are. First, which one of you wants to tell us how to actually pronounce Pendergast's first name?
I'll do that because I think I came up with that name, Aloysius.
And it's Irish, isn't it? Or Celtic?
Maybe Doug can answer that. I just thought it sounded Southern and Gothic to me, and that's why I chose it, or suggested it to Doug.
Well, it's an old, kind of an old Catholic name that I think is also French and it could be Irish. I mean, it goes way back.
So what does the X stand for?
Well, Pendergast, it was named after a river in South America called the Xingu River. And it's the reason he has that strange name is because he has an ancestor who was an explorer who disappeared in the 20s, exploring up that river looking for a lost city, a great, you know, legendary city. So in the Pendergast family, there are a lot of odd names. I mean, people don't get named John and Fred and you know, George. You know, they're Diogenes or Linnaeus, or, you know, Hezekiah, or Aloysius, Xingu.
You're ducking the question. What's the X for?
Xingu.
Oh, it is?
Yes, it's X-I-N-G-U, and it's a name, it's an Indian word.
Ah, okay. Yeah. I'm sorry, I didn't realize that Xingu started with an X.
Add to that, there are two interesting things. That lost relative was believed to have been eaten by cannibals. And if you open to the relic, the first page of Relic, you'll find that the action takes place in that same place.
I was fascinated to see that on agentpendergast.com, there's actually a family tree.
Oh, yes.
That one of you apparently created, or both of you.
It's very complicated. Actually, neither one of us created it. A a fan created it. Is she here? No. Okay, but anyway, there was a fan who created that tree for us and showed it to us, and we said, wow, that's incredible. We didn't know he had so many relatives. And she said, well, you wrote about all these people, and you said how they were related to Pendergast, but we'd never actually put it together in a tree. So that was pretty amazing.
So does he ever sleep, or does he just plug into a wall?
The other amazing thing about his family tree is how many of the members of that tree were either mentally defective, mentally deficient, outright insane, homicidal, or otherwise troubled.
Criminals and geniuses, the family.
And often simultaneously, often both.
But the interesting thing about the Pendergast tree is that the family was once very wealthy, and there were quite a number of branches, and these branches have all died off, and through inheritance, Pendergast has inherited everything. And that's why he is so wealthy, because he's inherited from all the collateral branches of his family that have gone dead, that have gone out of business. So he is, or at least he appears to be, the last living Pendergast. He appears to be.
Speaking of the last living Pendergast, he has had several brushes with death. He has been, according to agentpendergast.com, shot, stabbed, mauled, bricked up, and left to die. That's so Edgar Allan Poe, guys. Come on.
You wouldn't believe the research went into having to do that, too, suffering from all those things ourselves, you know.
Yeah, Lincoln did all the research. I bricked him up and, you know.
Yep. Shot me, stabbed me. It was terrible.
Which one of you survived a Cambodian death camp? Additional brushes with death. Scary.
That was Link's idea, though. We don't want to have any spoilers, but there's a really horrible scene in which a grave is dug, and Pendergast is going. I better not. I think Lincoln's motioning me to shut up.
No, I'm not. Go ahead.
The grave is dug for Pendergast himself. Anyway, I won't go any farther.
No, we want to do that. So, this is a quest novel, which means that our hero, you know, has to go on a journey to do something or other. And I'm not going to tell you what it is because it'll ruin it, so I'm going to call it The Instigating Incident. The Instigating Incident needs a landscape. And one of the things I think is fascinating about your books is that you go from the kind of commonplace, you know, ordinary, like a peaceful scene in New York to some terrible exotic world where volcanoes, we're in the jungle, or something or other. So why did you, or which of you decided with this one, or did you do it together, that the incident that kicks off this book and this quest would take place at the boathouse in Central Park in New York, a more innocuous place that's hard to imagine?
Well, Doug made his duties, but I believe I came up with that just because the site is such an attractive, you know, gingerbread site. You can imagine Cary Grant, you know, in the bishop's wife, you know, skating outside the boathouse in a frozen pond, and it just seemed so fairy tale like that it was a perfect spot for a really horrific gunfight to take place at. We're always looking for really interesting, and Doug, I'm sure, will agree with this. We're always looking for fascinating and colorful scenes to set our chapters in. You know, that makes it memorable, and it also resonates with the reader.
You know, if you remember, Link, we originally were going to set that like in some gritty waterfront neighborhood underneath the Brooklyn Bridge, and we decided, you know, that's kind of the kind of thing you'd see in a movie. You know, the tough guys, the shootout. We thought let's set it in a place that's totally beautiful and lovely and peaceful, and really surprise the reader with the violence that occurs.
That's right.
All of a sudden.
That's true. I'd even written the chapters that way, and then Doug
I rejected
said, no,
it.
No, no, this won't work. This is, anybody else would do this. We have to. We're precedent child. We have to do something different. So, you know, with great irritation and execrations at his family and his lineage.
I think it was
just a lot of the reader. I mean, you're there and you think it's beautiful, the moon's out, you know, you're peaceful people doing things, and, you know, it all looks absolutely wonderful. And then this man in a white suit, I mean, sorry, with white hair and a black suit is standing there, and you think it's going to be lovely. Ron.
One of the fun things about that chapter was, it was at the very end of Cold Vengeance, and it appears again at the beginning of Two Graves, to set the story off. And we knew the reader was going to figure out something terrible was probably going to happen. And so we populate that scene with, you know, a bum about to go to sleep in a packing crate, and we had a violinist playing for spare change, and a couple of people necking on a bench. And, you know, we had a lot of fun figuring out which ones would be good, which ones would be bad, which ones would be neutral, and trying to make sure that the reader couldn't figure out who was going to suddenly leap up with a gun in their hand. And that kind of thing is a lot of fun for us to do.
Well, what follows, I think, is a really interesting example of how they pull together both their scientific side and their sort of horror imaginative side, because in order to continue the quest, Pendergast collects a clue, which obviously lesser beings have missed, which is some gravel and some dirt, right? Some mud on a tire.
Yes.
And then you took over, and he goes through this amazing analysis with some help that he recruits, and then he uses like a mapping system to figure out where's the only place, you know, that the mud and the gravel and all could come from. I loved it. It was just, I could just see you sitting there, the science writer, working this one out.
Well, you know, it's interesting you should mention that, because when I worked at the Museum of Natural History, there was a scientist there named Sidney Horenstein, who was a geologist. And at a certain point, I mean, I got that idea from this, because at a certain point, the feds came to him and they said that they had a shipment of television sets or stereos or whatever, that huge, you know, many containers of these electronics. And when they opened up the boxes, they were full of gravel.
Yeah.
And that somewhere in the shipment had been stolen and substituted with gravel. And they went to Horenstein, they brought up a box full of gravel, and they said, where did the gravel come from? Where did this ship, this container ship, make the substitution? And he was able, as a geologist, to identify the from the geology of that gravel.
I knew this wasn't the part of the book you wrote, Lincoln. Well, anyway, I mean, I don't know about you guys, but I think that's one of the really interesting things about reading the books, is that sometimes you are doing sort of scientific stuff and Pendergast is being a genius, and then sometimes you're just in like horror land. Is that you? Is that the Lovecraftian you that comes in and devises some of the gothic moments?
I think to some degree. I think that Doug has a gothic taste too. We both love 19th century English novels, you know, by Wilkie Collins and the like, and you know, with Pendergast stories tend to lend themselves to gothic touches a lot more than, say, the Gideon Crew stories do. But yeah, you know, Doug and I think like to write the kind of story we'd like to read ourselves, and that's the kind of story that I prefer. And you know, and I'm a huge fan of the character Constance Greene, and she carries a gothic miasma with her wherever she goes, basically. And
you can't help but sort of, you know, there's a whole gothic subplot in this book involving Constance. It's not giving anything away to say that. And
yeah,
Felder,
Link has the hots for Constance.
What was that?
I said you have the hots for Constance, don't you?
Yeah. Okay, Doug, shut up.
Who may or may not be 150 years old, but I did want to mention one other land, well, a couple of other landscapes, but at some point, as we're on this quest with Pendergast, we wind up near the San Pedro River, which, as you know, is down in southern Arizona. And the minute I read that, I knew this was Doug, because this is the 20th anniversary year of Cities of Gold, which still remains one of my all-time favorite books ever. And Doug was down there at the bottom of Arizona, prepared to do his journey, you know, riding all the way up. So this is a landscape you really knew, and you brought it into play in the book, right?
Well, it is. In fact, we started riding our horses on the border of Arizona and Mexico, right there where there's a 5-strand barbed wire fence. And we thought, oh, it'd be cool to say we started in Mexico. We'll just jump over this fence. I mean, it's in the middle of nowhere, where the San Pedro River comes into Arizona. So we jumped over the fence, we came back, and instantly here were the helicopter overhead and these guys in these big green, you know, what do you call them, border patrol were there, and all right, everyone freeze, you know. And we had these horses that were packed, and they thought they were about to make the biggest drug bust of their careers. They were all looking for a promotion, and then when they realized we were just a bunch of half-assed cowboys about to ride, you know, and one of us had jumped over the fence and set off these sensors, they were so disappointed.
There's an interesting reverse variation that comes into play in the book. But so you come back to New York, and then without saying why, at some point in this book, we're spending time in Brazil. So which one of you decided that Brazil, or was this a joint decision, would be a really cool place for terrible things?
Well, actually, we didn't really have much of a choice in that matter. When people read the book, they will see, if they check the historical record, that what we talk about happening in Brazil is basically, for all intents and purposes, it did happen. Of course, we fictionalized it. We fictionalized the town and the location. But a lot of those events are true, and we had no choice to do it that way, although we did find out an incredible town in Germany.
In Brazil, you mean?
Sorry?
An incredible town in Brazil.
In Brazil, I'm sorry.
A German town.
Blumenau. Which, go ahead and describe it, Doug.
Well, what's interesting about the history of Brazil is that in the 19th century, Brazil was, there was nobody living. There were huge areas of Brazil that were empty. And the Brazilian government wanted to encourage people to settle, so said, anyone who comes to Brazil can get free land. And all these Germans came to Brazil and established towns that remained German. They speak German. They had nothing to do with Brazil. They wouldn't speak Portuguese. And these towns became very isolated and very kind of strange. And then during World War II, the Brazilians said, wait a minute, we've got all these parts of Brazil that are German-speaking. We've got to do something about that and force them to sort of join Brazil. But they never really did join. So towns like Blumenau in Brazil, you go to Blumenau, and it looks like Bavaria. I mean, all the houses are done in that half-timbered way. They all speak German. Nobody speaks Portuguese. And that's what made this so fascinating.
I think one of the really fun things about reading the books is you never know where you're going to go, to some exotic spot in the world that you hadn't thought about. Now that Lincoln's back, though, my eye fastened upon something I wrote down, which I think is really fun. I did not know that you were one of the people who worked with James Herriot on All Creatures Great and Small and other of his novels. That doesn't seem like you.
My role was pretty small. I came in fairly late in James Herriot's career and worked on such books as, you know, the best of. But it was my boss, Tom McCormick at St. Martin's Press, who I believe deserves the credit. My understanding of the story, for those people who know James Herriot, the English vet who wrote All Creatures Great and Small, those books, again, this is my understanding of it. Those books were kind of almost throwaway titles in England. You know, humor books with titles like It Couldn't Happen to a Vet or If Only They Could Talk. And I was told that Tom repackaged them with a new cover, you know, a new title, and a huge advertising campaign, and they really took off. And the rest was history. And he wrote several more books after that. And it was fascinating because he was certainly one of St. Martin's biggest authors at the time. And yeah, I got a letter or two from him myself, you know, and I practically had them framed on my wall. It was like getting, you know, being handed the testaments from the mound. It was really something.
Well, it is. I mean, it's easy to think that Herriot was all about bunnies and ponies, but in fact, being a vet has some really major stuff, you know, big animals and hard things happening. So maybe it hardens you up. One last thing I wanted to mention, what I thought was really fabulous in this book. I mentioned that it's a quest novel, and, you know, normally when people go off on quests to rescue the princess or save the kingdom or, you know, find the treasure or whatever it is, they're just into it, and there's not a lot of personal responsibility at all. They just, like, there's an irresistible impulse that takes them off. At some point in the story, and we won't tell you how, Pendergast stops. And he realizes that if he hadn't insisted upon this quest those things that happened would not have happened, and he takes responsibility for it. That is so cool. I don't remember ever seeing that in a book like this.
Well, it's a horrible moment for Pendergast. Almost when he realizes that he has done the worst possible thing he could have done. I can't say what it is because we don't want to spoil it, but he's responsible for it. It's a terrible moment, and it really is in a way it's sort of the end of his life.
And not really, because there's lots of pages to go.
Well, he's rescued in a sense. Again, can't go into details, but he's sort of rescued, and then he learns that things are a lot more complicated than he thought, and his quest is not over at all. He has to, and it's much worse. What he has to do and what has happened is even worse than what he could possibly imagine.
So. You guys have so
we get a lot of, if I can respond to that, we get a lot of obviously positive comments about Pendergast, a huge number of positive comments, but occasionally people say he's too perfect, things always work out for him, he doesn't have to, you know, break a sweat. And in this trilogy, we didn't really start out intending for this to happen. We, you know, in Fever Dream, we intended to sort of fill in his backstory, which is a request people often make. You know, what's Pendergast, you know, history? What happened? You know, how did he get where he is? And that's how we started out. But in the process of writing it, it turned into a real, you know, Pendergast agonistes. Basically, it's, you know, terrible things happen to him, some of which he, as in this case, brings on himself. And he doesn't know how to respond to them because he's never had this kind of problem before. And so for us, this has been a chance to really deeply humanize him. He's still a strained, you know, eccentric individual, but he has to somehow respond to these terrible things that are happening to him. And it's our hope people will come away from this trilogy, and particularly Two Graves, feeling a closer understanding of Pendergast and a more sympathy for him as a human being, just like the rest of us.
If you think of these books, as I often do, as an exploration of evil, is that what you think is at the heart of the books? Am I off track there?
No, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, what these books are, the whole Pendergast series, is a very deep exploration of evil. Pendergast himself is fascinated with evil. He grew up with it. I mean, he comes from a family where if he hadn't become an FBI agent, he might have become a criminal himself. I mean, he's a guy who sort of was on the edge and went one way, and his brother, of course, went the other. But it is very much an exploration of evil. What is it? The mystery of it, because the fundamental thing about evil is that it's incomprehensible at base.
So, Lincoln, is this, in other words, a book where the evil is personal to Pendergast more than it has been in other books where he's been, like when you were in Kansas?
Exactly, yeah. Right? Kansas was a vacation for him. You know, he was going to investigate a serial murder, and he could remain aloof from it. He could remain detached from it as he analyzed it and studied it. But here, it's his own family that's you know, bearing the brunt of this horrible thing. And, you know, he's never had to deal with this kind of thing before, or at least certainly not at this level and in many, many years since the unpleasantness with his brother took place. It was really a chance for us to sort of stretch ourselves out a bit and break the mold. You know, that's one good thing about having two authors involved is we never let ourselves rest or get comfortable. We're always trying to push ourselves and our characters and our stories in new directions. And that was really the case here. I mean, we had no idea when we started this trilogy where we'd end up. I mean, that these terrible and fascinating and terrible things would happen and these surprises. And I don't know if we would actually have taken this on had we known where we were going to end up. But at the end of the day, Pendergast's life has been turned upside down, inside out. But, you know, he emerges from it with, I like to think, a whole new worldview.
Yeah, I do agree. I think that's really insightful. You know, Pendergast is it's a strange thing. We don't really understand Pendergast ourselves. He does things in our books that we have to figure out. Not like any of our other characters where we understand them, we know what they're going to do, we've got their backstories written out, we know where they went to college, we know what kind of music they listen to, but with Pendergast, he's always doing things that are surprising, that we don't quite get, that we have to stop and say, wait a minute, why did he do that? I know it sounds strange because we're creating him, but that's the reality of writing him. He's hijacks the story. He does weird things. He's a weird dude.
He is a weird dude, but don't you think then, as novelists, when you create a character, because you have to start somewhere. I mean, he isn't like just born. He's already formed. There's an impulse to go back and learn about his past, or, you know, bring facets that when you first wrote him in book one didn't come up.
Well, that's right. I mean, when we first wrote him, the first few books, we didn't even know his first name. And it didn't occur to us that we didn't know it. It was like he was Pendergast. And then people would say, what's his first name? And we're like, huh, wow, what is his first name? You got to call him up and ask him. To me, Pendergast is more real than a lot of allegedly real people I know. He's so real to me as a character.
There are other characters in the book that we've met before, though, in Two Graves. So who'd you bring back in this one? You can mention them without spoiling anything. There's Vincent, right?
Well, one of our favorite characters, one of our most beloved characters, is Corey Swanson. And she comes back in Two Graves. She was also present in some of the earlier books, but she really comes back in Two Graves in a big kind of a, she has her own subplot. Which
that's because Doug has the hots for her.
and actually, in the next Pendergast novel, which we just completed, which we're calling White Fire, Corey is, it's just like Still Life with Crows. It's Pendergast and it's Corey, you know, teaming up. So she really comes back into our books in a big way. We hope you approve. Who here doesn't like Corey? No? All right, let's hear it for Corey. Good.
So who'd you bring back?
I'd like to address your earlier point about the characters in our books and how we didn't expect, you know, them to develop the way they did. In Relic, we had lots of throwaway lines we were later able to mine to our advantage. For example, we have a character, Coffee, you know, one of the bad guys, tell Pendergast, why don't you go off and eat that catfish sandwich your wife made for you? And Pendergast gets as close to, you know, strangling somebody with his bare hands as he ever does in our books. And later in the book, we learn his wife was a great hunter, a great shot, better than Pendergast himself. And these were throwaway moments to sort of just help propel the story along. But later on, that became the seed from which the entire story of Fever Dream sprouted. You know, in one of our books, I believe it was Cabinet of Curiosities, we have Pendergast undertake a memory crossing in which he passes through his family mansion and the door of his brother in his mind is bolted shut, never to be opened. We just thought that was like a nice titillating bit for the reader to wonder about. And in both cases, those became huge, you know, aspects of his life. You know, Helen Pendergast in the Fever Dream trilogy and Diogenes in the Diogenes trilogy. And we had no idea at the time they'd become part of his universe, but now they're integral parts. And it's funny how the whole thing is sort of very reflexive. You know, it folds back in on itself. And everything, we try and make all the things tie together. The people, the events, the history. And there's plenty of Pendergast history still to be mined. Take our recent short story, Extraction, for example.
So I've asked some questions. What do you want to say about the book, Doug? And then maybe Lincoln will say.
Well, this story, when we started Fever Dream, we thought we knew where we were going. And we had all kinds of ideas about how this was going to end. And it turns out that looking back, we had absolutely no idea what we were getting ourselves into and what direction this book was going to go in. And I think that we're both of us pretty flabbergasted and astonished at where this story ended up. I mean, wouldn't you say so, Link?
Yes, definitely. Like I said earlier, there are so many shocks and surprises and twists in Two Graves in particular that it throws Pendergast's, you know, fairly comfortable life for such a loop. I don't know if we would have had the heart to do that to him at the beginning of Fever Dream had we known where we were going to be going with it.
I don't believe that for a minute. I don't think authors have any conscience at all about what they do to their characters.
No.
Sorry.
We do. I still feel terrible about what happened to Bill Smith back. I mean, that was Link's fault. No. He killed Bill Smith back because Bill Smith back was based on me. See?
So, Lincoln, do you have any extra words you want to add about Two Graves? And then we could take questions from the audience.
I feel sort of that I'm weighed down by I have to take the fifth on that because I can't break any spoilers. But as I said earlier, we were really excited about this book. We're incredibly happy that it's out now because people have been waiting so long to find out what happens after Cold Vengeance and find out how we can possibly tie together all these disparate, loose ends. And I think we've accomplished it. I hope we've accomplished it. And so I'm just eager to sort of sit back and hear what people have to say about it now.
That's true. It's been 16 months, hasn't it, since Cold Vengeance came out.
Yeah, way too long. We've gotten a lot of complaints about that.
So maybe the next one, White Fire, will come out sooner?
White Fire is done, so it's going to be published probably in another 6 months.
Whoa.
So you will get the next Pendergast novel really quickly to make up for the long delay for this one.
Yay!
And we are really, really excited about White Fire, by the way. We think it's an incredibly strong book. That's off topic for today, but we couldn't be happier with how it turned out.
And it is a standalone novel. We're not starting another huge involved trilogy. It's a standalone novel. It's self-contained, and so.
Yeah, we don't want any more emails about how can you do this to me? You know, this is duplicitous. You know, I didn't know this was going to be have a cliffhanger ending. So White Fire is completely self-contained.
So, audience, do you have questions that you want to ask? You can ask either author, but Doug is going to need to repeat them.
Yes. Will Coffee come back? Link, do you remember what happened to Coffee? Wasn't he sent to, like...
The Waco Field Office.
The Waco Field Office, yeah. You know, I hadn't thought about
The Return of
that.
Asian Coffee. Yeah, he'll come back as a shambling zombie in one of our future books.
Actually, you know, we hadn't thought of that before, but he was a really charming character. I'd love to see him again. What a lovely guy.
Wait, didn't he come back? Wasn't he in the Diogenes trilogy?
Was he?
He came back and was so pleased that Pendergast was in prison, right?
Oh, yes, that's right.
Yeah.
All right.
So I don't know what happened to him after that. I think he's done now.
Well, I don't know. We don't know. You never know what's going to happen.
Never say never.
All right. All right, next question. Yes. Well, thank you. Well, the question is, how much research do we do compared to writing? And, we do a tremendous amount of research. I mean, one of the things is we feel that the reader may not have a lot of knowledge about the subject, but they can tell when you're faking it. So you really have to not only do the research, but you have to go to the places, in the large part, you have to actually go to the places where the novels are set. Otherwise, the settings aren't quite real, they don't feel right. And so, because Lincoln won't leave his house, I have to go to all these places. And
Why should I?
It was, but the toughest research I ever had to do was like the next novel, White Fire, is set in Aspen, Colorado. And I had to go there. It was really tough. It's really tough.
We benefit from having two authors because, you know, Doug has a great background in science, and I know a lot about computers, and so we can always fob off certain chapters onto each other. You know, you mentioned this, Barbara, you mentioned the chapter about the soil in Two Graves. You know, Doug was able to pull that off without breaking a sweat just because of his scientific knowledge.
Were you the person, though, that did all was it GPS or was it mapping? I guess it was the mapping thing. Was that Lincoln or was that
The mapping of the gravel?
Yeah.
No, that was me, too.
That was Doug.
I worked out that whole little detail. Yeah.
I wrote the more gothic elements, like the subplot dealing with Constance, you know, that kind of thing. And as usual, the chapters set from the crazed axe murderer were done by me.
Yeah, Lincoln's really good at that, getting into their heads.
Yeah.
He doesn't look it, but, you know, there have been a lot of weird serial killings in Morristown, New Jersey, where he lives. But he says he never leaves his house. I don't know. Uh-oh. What were you doing with that while that was off? That's what I want to know.
Burning the evidence.
Disposing of the corpse. All right. Any other questions? Yes. Well, I thank you very much. That is very, yes. Oh, that's a good question. Lincoln, answer, why is there a movie with no, with why, where's the Pendergast movie?
Well, there was a Pendergast movie almost. He appeared in the first draft of the screenplay, but he eventually ended up on the cutting room floor, and we don't know why for sure. We speculate either it was too hard to write his character into a 90-minute movie, or they couldn't think of what actor should play him, although there have been practical books written since on what actors would be appropriate to play Pendergast. But through some strange legal quirk, because he appeared in the book, the makers of the movie still own the rights to him. And so until Paramount decides either to give him up or to make another film from one of our books, he languishes in cinematic obscurity.
No, Paramount Pictures controls the movie rights to his character, and until they wake up and realize what they've got, they're not going to do anything. So what we need to do is to galvanize a movement, Free Pendergast. Somebody start a Facebook page aimed at Paramount Pictures and...
Free Pendergast, that's really cool. Actually, what generally will happen is you have to wait for some actor to attach himself to the character. And speaking of actors attaching themselves to the character, where are we with George Clooney and the Monster of Florence?
Well, that movie is still in progress. And I read a screenplay, I read two screenplays, two versions, and I think they're very good. And they're still, you know, it takes a long time. I don't know why it takes so long, but they're now talking about who's going to direct the movie. So they're looking for a director. And there is a movie coming out soon called Jack Reacher, or Reacher, I think. Are you Lee Child's movie? They think that the director of that, who's Christopher McQuarrie, maybe the director of The Monster of Florence, which I think is a great idea because I hear this is a wonderful movie. So, are you all looking forward to it, by the way? Okay. No?
Okay.
Yeah, all right, casting problems.
Tom Cruise is my size, and Jack Reacher is at least 18 inches taller than I am. So I think there's a little credibility problem. It'd be like having Pendergast if he were swarthy with dark curly hair and wore blue, you know, wore electric blue suits.
But it's amazing what you can do with lifts.
That's true. Is there going to be a new edition of The Monster of Florence, or was
yes,
added material?
There is. In March, the end of March, a new edition of Monster is coming out with a new afterword, which updates the case, but also talks about the really interesting connections between the Monster Florence case and the Amanda Knox case, you know, the Kircher murder trial. They're very interesting connections. So, very interesting, which Mario uncovered in Italy that'll blow your mind.
Lincoln, you started a series with an interesting new character. Can you tell us a little bit about what went on with him? It was last January when, in fact, we did an event with you at the Poison Pen, again by Skype, and talked about it.
That book was called The Third Gate. It features my series character, Jeremy Logan, who's an enigmologist. I sort of took that strange profession from the supernatural sleuths of the turn of the century. There were many, many supernatural sleuths or ghost breakers, as they called them, who were like private eyes who investigated strange, unknown, supernatural, or seemingly supernatural events, and found out that either they had a reasonable, rational explanation or they had a supernatural explanation, and proceeded to essentially exorcise that demon. And this seemed fascinating to me, and I felt it was high time to resurrect that kind of series. It seemed certainly in line with my interest in ghost stories and the occult. So it's proving to be a really interesting and fun journey. You know, I mean, books like Relic, for example, you know, we put so much science into them, real and fake, that when you get to the point of the brain-eating monster, you don't disbelieve, because we've already suspended your disbelief by all that long recitation of science and seemingly correct and believable analysis and investigation. And the same thing happens in the Jeremy Logan books. I'm really enjoying teasing that out and finding new bizarre Ghostbuster-ish avenues for him to explore.
Doug, where are you? You haven't done a standalone for a little while.
Yeah, my standalone publisher is screaming bloody murder, but I'm going to be working on one soon.
And, I don't know how either one of you has time to. I mean, it, you know, just doing the books you're doing together is so time consuming. The thought that you're doing stuff on the side seems incomprehensible.
Well, anyway.
Maybe to your publisher also, huh? Does anybody else have a question they'd like to ask?
Yes. Well, thank you. Thank you. Well, I have to say I really appreciate your excellent literary taste.
You know, this is really interesting. Think about it. This lady who spoke earlier said she came from Florida, and this lady's come from Illinois, and I already know there are two ladies over here because they came to see me yesterday.
And we have
Washington and New York or New Jersey. Is anybody else here from out of state?
Knoxville, Tennessee.
Wow.
Hawaii. Whoa.
And what about you over there? Nashville.
And Portland, Oregon, right? Oh, Medford, Oregon. I mean, this, by the way, over here is Team Pendergast. Stand up. There they are.
Yay. That's really awesome. You know, you guys should be truly touched that people have flown long distances in order to come and see you this evening.
How can people be so mistaken? I'm sorry, no.
More questions?
Well, now we divide the writing responsibilities a little more equally, and we each take a thread or a series of chapters and write that, and then we swap the chapters, and then Lincoln will rewrite my Shakespearean level prose, which really pisses me off, and then of course I have to correct his very crude semi-literate English as well, but anyway, we through this process we managed to come up with something that is fairly I think a style of writing, actually speaking seriously, that's really quite better than what we could have achieved on our own. So,
do you want to speak to that, Lincoln, before we move on?
Yeah, I'll ignore the first part because he says that at every book signing and it never gets any funnier than it was the first time he said it. but we these days, each book we write tends to have a champion. You know, one of us champions that book, sees it forward, writes the majority of chapters, not all, but the majority, and enlists the help of the other when we get stuck. And Doug tends to write faster than I do, so I tend to enlist his help more than he enlists mine. But in terms of outlining the books, reading each other's chapters, discussing what needs to happen next, it's a completely joint effort.
Will, you have a question from the online audience, right?
Team Pendergast quote off. That's right. We have to do that again. That was incredible.
Wait, what was that? I didn't hear that.
The Team Pendergast quote off. Do you remember that?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Lincoln, tell about that. That was unbelievable.
You go ahead, Doug.
Well, the Team Pendergast had posted quotes, and everyone had to figure out quickly, you know, which book the quote came from. And Lincoln and I lost. I mean, it was humiliating. Oh, my God. Anyway, it was really fun. And then if you go to Team Pendergast, you see that there's a quote of the day or quote of the week. And I read these quotes and I think, gosh, those are clever. Who wrote that? Oh, I wrote that. Link didn't write any of them, just me.
We're planning to employ those quotes in the upcoming Pendergast file, too, because we think that's just too great an idea not to mine further.
Yes, that's something that we were going to talk to you all about is to write our next Pendergast file. You gather the best quotes, and then we'll send it out in our newsletter, which, by the way, do you all know what the newsletter is? Yeah, good. Okay, so.
Wasn't there a question over here somewhere? John?
I can speak to that. We both feel very strongly about Smithback. We like him a lot. We've given him some of our best lines. We sort of feel like he was us in the books. And, you know, there was a point in time where we were thinking of killing off Margot Green, and we would or Viola Masculine, a few characters like that. And we would, at our book signings, we would ask people, you know, what should we kill them? You know, who should we kill off? Or should we kill off nobody? And people would say, kill off Bill Smithback. You know, he's such a windbag, you know, and we got very insulted at that, you know, because we identified with him. And so we decided to kill him off in Cemetery Dance because, basically, for two reasons. First of all, the poor guy had suffered through so much. I mean, he'd been chased by monsters in sub-basements of museums. He'd been operated on without anesthetic. We didn't want to ask him to do any more, you know, work for the cause, and it was time to put the poor guy some rest. And the second reason was, if we would kill off as major a character as Smithback, we wanted to send a message that nobody was safe in our books, you know, so that when you see somebody in real danger in our story, they may well actually end up gone. And those are the two major reasons that we decided. And believe me, it was not easy, because once you have a character as fully fleshed as Smithback, he's fairly easy to write into future books. So we took a big hit by killing him off, but we felt it was worth it, although we took a lot of abuse for doing so.
All right, yes. Well, Helen's name came from Helen of Troy, the face that launched 1,000 ships. Right, Link?
You lost me there. I don't know. You make that up?
I'm quoting Homer, you dolt.
I know who you're quoting, you idiot. But I don't recall that being where her name came from. But you may well be right.
No,
and
I.
By the way, you're not quoting Homer. By the way, you were quoting.
That's right. Yeah.
Ben Johnson.
Uh-oh. See, he's always. Link is smarter than I am. He gets me every time. Yeah. Well, I always thought it was after Helen of Troy, but.
You may well be right.
All right. Yes, another internet question? Will we go into any other mediums like graphic novels? Well, you know, Lincoln and I are really keen on graphic novels. We think they're really great. And we would love to do a graphic novel. And maybe we will someday. You know, that is definitely of interest. So. Yes. All right. Okay. Well, her role in Two Graves, what happens to her there has a happy ending. So, yeah. Yes. Well, you could, if you wanted to, scan it and email it to us. Oh, you have it here. Well, you can give it to me afterwards. I mean, yeah, take it out and here, bring it over here and show it to Lincoln. All right. We love our work. We have a section of our website where fans make pictures. That's great. Fans make pictures, and we post them on the website and so forth. So if any of you are artists out there, send us your work. Okay, Link, here you go.
A bit higher, please.
Higher?
Wow, that's amazing. Fantastic. Good job.
That's Smith back. Hurricane deck. There you go. In Utah. Smith back on hurricane deck.
That's wonderful.
That was right before he came off the horse. That's good. I love that. That's great. Well, thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Here. Yeah, show it to the internet. Show it to everyone on the internet too. So yeah, so please, anyone has poetry, pictures, photographs or whatever, scan it and send it to us, and we'll, unless it's, you know, if it's appropriate, we will put it up on our website. So
even family trees, apparently.
Yes.
You can, yeah, make your own and volunteer it. You know what? I wanted to ask you, you have written some books. We're talking about Pendergast. This is the 12th Pendergast. But haven't you written together 18 novels?
I don't know.
Well, I think it's 18 novels.
18.
Okay, so there are at least four or five, anyway,
yeah,
that are not necessarily Pendergast novels. I remember Ice Limit. Have you thought about doing something like that, a step away really from the series at this point?
We have two series now, Pendergast and Gideon Crew, and I think Doug will agree with me that those are going to occupy all of our time for the foreseeable future, and any other ideas that we have will be treated by solo novels.
But I will say this, I don't know how many of you are waiting for a sequel to The Ice Limit. Okay. It's coming. Yeah. It's coming.
You're the only people I know. Which book was it where you created, wasn't it a cofferdam? You had a treasure or something out in the ocean and you had to do this marine technology
thing? That was Riptide, yeah.
Riptide, that was it. I was so blown away by, you know, how that worked. And I think that the fun of maybe occasional standalones is you get to do something like that.
Well,
maybe
we
you could do it with Pendergast in it and he could fall into the Riptide and there you'd be, but...
Yeah. Yeah, that's it's interesting because some of those standalone novels we've taken characters from and brought them into the Pendergast universe. I mean, like Eli Glynn brought into the Pendergast universe, and now we've brought him into the Gideon Crew universe. So there's a lot of cross-pollination among these characters.
Don't you guys call us like the Pendergrass Panagia? Don't you have a like an umbrella name for all of this?
Yes.
The Metaverse.
Or Pangea. But, you know, Pangea was the great supercontinent that formed, 300 million years ago. Anyway.
I wasn't really that off when I said it's like stepping through the wardrobe, except instead of the lion and the witch, you found your own, or you created your own.
Well, let me say one thing on a philosophical note. The cosmologists believe that the universe might be infinite. And if the universe is infinite, anything that's possible to happen is happening. So right now, somewhere in the universe, these novels are really happening for real. Pendergast actually lives.
You're going to comment, or are you just going to sit there in your blue shirt?
If you say so.
That was a good time to wave that martini glass again.
Yeah, it's about time. I think it's high
it
time.
It was.
I'm driving Lincoln to drink with these comments.
Does anybody have a final question they'd like? Is there a last question? Yes, sir.
Yes. Sorry, where did my inspiration for what? Ah, that's interesting. Well, I can speak for myself here. I think Lincoln also has an interest in this, but I've been very interested in Tibetan Buddhism for a long time. Ever since in 1991, I spent a week with the Dalai Lama in Santa Fe, acting as his press secretary. It's kind of a crazy story. And I went up the ski mountain with him and everything. And so that's where my interest comes from. Which, by the way, I've written an article for The New Yorker about this, which I sold to them, and it'll be coming out in a couple of months. So, nonfiction. I'm not lying for once. Yeah, Lincoln, have we ever thought of killing off Pendergast?
No, but you've actually suggested it once or twice. Do you remember that? We were casting
no, I did not.
Ideas?
What are you talking about? You suggested it.
No. We will never kill off Pendergast. He wouldn't allow us to, even if we wanted to.
So there's no ultimate spoiler. We may have avoided a bunch of them, but the one thing we do know is there's going to be a Pendergast 13, right? So no matter what happens to him at the end,
it's in the oven right now.
And in 6 months, or you know, probably this book will come out, so you won't have to wait. White Fire,
fabulous, and we'll get to do this again. What really great fun! So I want to thank our authors. I hope you'll congratulate them once again on completing this. And I'm sure they're going to join me in saying that without you all, if you didn't come, if you didn't buy and read their books, not the three of us wouldn't be here.
Well, yes.
And so we're grateful to you.
Well, thank you. And I'd like to add my gratitude to Barbara of the Poison Pen Bookstore, who has been supporting me and also me and Lincoln for most of my career, for over 20 years, maybe 25 years. One of my first book signings when I was totally unknown and was so desperate to sell one book. I had a book signing in the Poison Pen Bookstore two iterations back. The bookstore has moved three times or twice. And so I'm very grateful to Barbara. And also I love coming to Phoenix, Arizona, because we always get great audiences here. People are just fantastic in this town. So so thank you all for coming.
And Lincoln, thank you for staying up late in your office, whether you're swilling gin or whatever you're doing to stay awake. And I'm sorry that your dog is too unreliable to have joined us, because I really enjoyed the dog last time.
I'll try and post some Facebook pictures of the dog that will make up for that.
Or maybe you could do some obedience training between now and June.
The dog is 7 years old. I'm afraid that she's, set in her ways.
Just trank the dog and drag her in.
There are two things I wanted to add in closing. The first is, thinking about it, I realized it was
Kit Marlowe, Christopher Marlowe, who wrote Dr. Faustus, not Ben Jonson. So please, I don't want to get 100 emails tomorrow saying how illiterate I was about that. But second, and much more importantly, you know, events like these don't just happen spontaneously. I mean, this event has been being planned for months. You know, 150 boxes of books were sent to my house. I spent a day signing them. They then, through a very complicated method, were sent out to Arizona, where Doug spent 2 days, I think, signing and inscribing them, so we could bring this off. And so what seems hopefully, you know, a smooth procedure to you has many, many people behind it. It's got Grand Central behind it, the Poison Pen Bookstore. And in closing, I'd like to thank two people in particular, and I'm echoing Doug in this. First, Barbara, for hosting this and for believing in us and in pushing us and prodding us to make this happen. And secondly, all you people who came such great distances in some cases and who, you know, support us who are watching this right now in Arizona or maybe watching this tomorrow on the internet, thank you for your interest. Thank you for your support. And it's because of all of you that we are able to keep writing our books. So thank you very much.
I'd like to add my special thanks to your editor, Mitch Hoffman, and also to your brand new publicist, Sonia Chose, who took on this project from out of the ether and has really soldiered through it, you know, because she it was all new to her. She's been fabulous.
Yeah, we have this great new publicist, Sonia, and we have a new editor, Mitch Hoffman, who's fantastic. And also, I think we ought to thank Will for, Will? Thank
yes.
you. Will Hanisco, who made this happen technically. And
not to mention the Arizona Biltmore. So all of the books that the Two Graves have already been signed by Lincoln and by Doug. If you do not want to stand in line to get your book inscribed, you can take your autographed book with our thanks and depart. And I want to wish you all a happy holiday. If you'd like to have Doug, and since clearly Lincoln can't unless we get one of those electronic pens or something, Doug is going to go back and sit at a table back there in the back, the one with the two chairs there, and he'll be happy to write messages in your book or chat with you, or you can take photos or anything else you would like to do. So ladies and gentlemen, happy holidays to you. Thank you again for coming.
Thank you.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.